Hello, this is D. Garrett Nadeau, and I'm here today with another podcast. The purpose of these podcasts is to discuss writers and various writing topics, with an emphasis on Lancashire writing and writers, but including a broad range of subjects from all over England, and regular musical interludes to vary your listening experience. My guest for this podcast is Jill MacDonald Constable, also known as Amos Carr, also known as Gil, is that right? Gil MacDonald. Yeah. Okay. Thank you and for coming and welcome, Jill.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, no problem. Can we start, first of all, with your background, a little bit about like where you were born and your childhood and all that
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, well, I was actually born in Liverpool.
Right.
When it was still Lancashire. But unfortunately, my mother had the wanderlust, so we didn't stay in Liverpool very long. We moved all around every area of Lancashire, I think, really. Living in pet shops and living on farms and all over the place. We even ended up for 2 years, I think, in Scotland, running a pet shop in Scotland.
Right, yeah. So she was like an animal lover then? Was that the main reason moved around from place to place?
She is a fanatical animal lover.
Right. Yeah, so she. Yeah. What kind of animals are we talking about? Horses, presumably? And
no, she never had horses. It was mainly dogs with her.
Dogs, okay.
And any other animal that she could get her hands on, really, except horses.
So did she have a dog grooming business, or...?
She bred dogs to start with. She bred
Samoyeds,
the big white fluffy ones, like huskies.
Oh,
she
fantastic.
Bred them for a long time. Then she worked at greyhound kennels for a while, and then she started a pet shop. And I've not got this in chronological order, but
that's all right. Yeah, yeah.
I think we had three different pet shops over the years.
Right, okay.
So... various different animals of all
different
shapes.
So you grew
shapes.
Up with loads of pets all the time. Yeah. Did you have any in the house? Did you have to take some? Did you take lambs home or anything like that, or did they mostly stay in the pet shop?
No, mostly they stayed in the pet shop. You can't have lambs in pet shops.
Okay. That shows you how much I know about pet shops.
No, mostly they stayed in the pet shops. Yeah. No, we didn't have any strange animals actually living in the house. Mainly just dogs and rabbits.
What about cats?
Cats occasionally. She didn't like cats as much as
so what sort of pets are we talking about that she sold? Are we talking about birds?
In the pet shop, yeah.
In the pet shop.
Anything. Reptiles.
Oh, reptiles as well.
Fish, birds,
right,
cats,
all this,
dogs.
Okay.
In those days, pet shops were allowed to sell cats and dogs off the premises, which they're not really allowed to now. And they were able to sell things like Natterjack toads, which are now very endangered species, and
you can't have
them in pet shops anymore.
Well, did you have to have a license to sell pets in a pet shop, or how does that work?
I don't think
anybody have a pet shop and just collect some animals, buy some animals, and sell them?
No, I think these days you do need a license.
Right.
But when my mum was doing it back in the day, I don't think she needed
a license
for that.
Right.
No. And she sold all sorts of strange and unusual things.
So what was your schooling like then? What was school like for you? Did lots of kids come running around to your pet shop and say, "Oh, I want to look at all the pets"? Or
no, it wasn't good. I was bullied a lot because I was different
to all
the others. So yeah, and because we moved around so much, I was in lots of different schools.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just managed to make a few friends in one school, and then we'd be up sticks and move off to another area and have to make friends.
So
did you
get into reading then? Did you enjoy reading? Because you felt like you were isolated from the rest. Is that right, or did you not care whether?
I didn't care. I was quite happy.
Just being you,
really.
Yeah,
Reading and writing, English and art were my favourite subjects at school, and I was always very good at them. So.
Right. So you got into reading. If you liked English, you obviously got into reading fairly early on. You liked reading.
Oh, I could read well before I went to school. Yeah.
Oh wow! Yeah. Great. Yeah. 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 So you kind of always had that spark in you then, really, even before you sort of took up. When would you say you did start to become interested in writing?
I think, like most young teenagers, I wrote a lot of poetry to get rid of all the angst that you go through.
Sure.
I think a lot of teenagers do that.
Yeah.
It wasn't until a fair bit later that I started writing any longer pieces of work. It was mostly poetry to start with.
Right. And then I think you won a contest then. Do you want to tell us about that?
The
Vietnam War poem that you wrote?
Oh, no, it wasn't a contest.
Oh, I thought it was a competition or something.
No, it was when I was, I can't remember if it was either 13 or 14. And there'd been quite a lot about the Vietnam War around and about by that time. And it seemed to strike a chord with me. And I wrote a reasonable long poem about it and sent it to the Lancashire Evening Telegraph.
Right.
And they actually published it along with the full page spread on the Vietnam War. And just seeing my words in print for the first time.
Yeah, that's great. That's your name at
something.
The bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
Your real name.
My real name. I've got so many of them these days. Yeah.
Seems like it.
That just sparked something in me. And from that day, I knew that all
that's
I wanted
what
to
you
do
wanted
was
to
be
do.
A writer.
Right. Yeah. So would you say from that point on that you practiced, I'm using that word practice, I mean that you wrote every day. Did you keep a diary or a journal? Or?
My diary keeping was very sporadic.
Yeah.
But I did try to write something as often as I could.
Yeah, yeah.
It was mainly, as I say, poetry and short stories to start with.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you finished school fairly early at that stage. You didn't want to carry on with your education because you weren't sort of kind of into books and all that sort of stuff. And then you had a series of jobs, various jobs kind of doing...
lots of different jobs, yeah, in offices and in factories and all over the place, yeah, yeah, window dressing and all sorts of things.
That sounds an interesting one, window dressing. How did you get into that?
Well, it was just the shop that I was working in was an outfitting, school outfitting shop.
And
it sold various other types of fashions and things as well.
Right.
And the lady who used to do the windows for all the departments in the store was ill one day, and we needed the windows doing because it was changing seasons. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah.
So my boss asked me if I would do it, and I carried on doing it for that department.
Did that parallel your interest in art then, would you say? I mean, was there a fashion aspect to your interest in art? Because you mentioned earlier, I think, that English and art were the subject you were famous, you're most popular with you. Did that carry on from the art? Was there a connection there, do you think, in terms of
I think the fact that I'd enjoyed art so much at school, and I'd always been scribbling all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that helped me with being able to make the window displays look quite nice. Yeah, because they were very pleased with it, and they asked me to carry on. So
So did you paint as well at the same time? Did you do paintings or sculptures or did you not carry on with your art interests really?
Well, I did a lot of cartoony type drawings.
Right. Okay.
But I've
illustrations. What do you call them? Like illustrations, kind of things.
I suppose.
Did they go along with your writing, or were they completely separate?
No,
so you didn't write something and then draw a little drawing to go along with it. You never had this, because a lot of writers seem to want to when they write a book, especially a children's book, they do the illustrations as well. Yeah. But that was never something that you were.
No, it never went together.
Yeah. Okay. So, but then you decided that you wanted to get into teaching, as I understand it. That you thought at some point in time you decided. How did that come about? That.
It was an accident, really, I think. we had to move. We were living in Kent at the time, myself and my husband were living in Kent at the time. And he had a bad accident and couldn't work anymore.
Right.
So we moved back up to Lancashire to be close to my family.
Yeah.
And because he was unable to work, we decided that I should go back to work full time.
Oh, I see, right.
And because I didn't have any real qualifications for anything in particular, I went back to college, to night school. And did a few cultural studies and things like that, various different bits and pieces, which ended up in me having a cultural studies degree.
Right, okay.
And after that, a lot of the people that were on the degree course decided they were going to go into teaching, so I decided, well, I'll do
that
the same
like
thing.
A, oh, yeah. Okay. Maybe we'll have a bit of a break there, and we'll listen to the first record that you've chosen, which is called Champagne Taste by Home Free.
The other day I checked my bank account, and I could swear it was the wrong amount, and I didn't understand because I'd been working hard. For the life of me, I didn't know where it went. I hadn't even paid the rent. Then the Mercedes pulled up in the yard. Oh, Lord, I should have seen it coming. This time I'm in deep. Now I'm heading to the poorhouse or heading to jail. And if I end up there, I ain't making bail. And if it goes to court, I sure don't have a case. Cause I ran out of money some time ago. But if you look at my wife, you'd never know. I'm afraid my baby's got champagne taste. On a beer budget. throat dried up and my heart just sunk as she motioned me over and popped the trunk, and I tried to ignore her absent-minded smile. And boy, I was greeted by quite the crew. There's Louis Vuitton and some Jimmy Choo, and that was just the fellas who were sitting on top of the pile. I said, baby, there's a Walmart a block away, and I don't think they sell these brands. Now I'm heading to the bar, I'm sure heading to jail, and if I end up there, I ain't making bail. And if it goes to court, I sure don't have a case, 'cause I ran out of money some time ago. But if you look at my wife, you'd never know. I'm afraid my baby's got champagne taste on a beer budget. All the bills are in my name.
All the bills are in his name.
They're gonna haul my ass away. And I won't see her pretty face at all. 'Cause the prison's nowhere near the mall.
Now I'm heading to the barhouse or heading to jail. Up there, I ain't making bail. And if it goes to court, I sure don't have a case. 'Cause I ran out of money some time ago. But if you look at my wife, you never know. I'm afraid my baby's got champagne taste
on a beer budget.
Okay, that was Champagne Taste by Home Free. Jill, would you like to tell us a little bit about why you chose that?
It's because I like various different kinds of music. And when I heard the first song that I heard by them, I was quite attracted to it. They're an a cappella group, but they have beatbox, what they call beatbox artists. I suppose you know what that is, no?
Tell me. Remind me.
It's where they just use their voice to make the sounds of the instruments.
Right, okay. Yeah, oh, that's good.
So it's a group of, I think it's five American lads.
Yeah.
And whatever you hear them singing, although it sounds like there are instruments, there are no instruments. It's all done by their voices. And I found that absolutely fascinating.
Okay.
So I think that's why I like this one, because it's such a catchy one as well.
Yeah. We'll get back to your history in a minute, but I just raised a question in my mind. Do you listen to music when you write? What's your writing routine like?
I don't really have a routine. Because I'm on my own now, so I can please myself where and when I write.
Right, so you don't have a regime where you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
No, definitely not. I get up at about 7:30, 8 o'clock every day, and feed the dogs and have my breakfast and check the computer, and then I decide whether I'm going to write or whether I'm going to procrastinate.
Oh, okay. Which one wins? Well, obviously,
procrastination.
The writing must win, because you've written quite a few books. We'll get to that in a little bit.
But, yeah, I do try to write something every day. I try to write a minimum of 1,000 words.
Wow,
a day.
That's quite, to me, that's quite a lot. So that's
really?
that sounds pretty good. Yeah. No, I think 1,000 is good. I'd be delighted if I wrote 1,000 words a day, which I don't.
I can't always do it every day, of course, but I do try for it, yeah.
No. That leads me into, because one of my big weaknesses is I go off on a tangent with research, and I was going to talk to you about research because, well, we'll come back to that in a little bit, but just to touch on it now. Most of what you write are what I guess I would call cowboy books, aren't they? And I would imagine that you have to do some research for that. Although you have horses and you know about horses, but have you spent a lot of time going back and looking at the history of the real history of the American West in the 1870s and all of that sort of thing, or do you just sort of base it on?
Not really. I do a little bit of research if I'm a bit stuck for what sort of gun they would use perhaps, or something like that. All my research really comes from all the time that I used to waste watching cowboy movies and cowboy serials when I was a kid. That was all I ever watched.
And Roy Rogers.
No, I don't think we had Lash LaRue in this country.
Oh,
I think he's an American
thing. He was my favorite. I like Lash LaRue. Every Saturday morning, Lash LaRue would come on. He had a whip. He didn't have a gun.
Of course,
he didn't use a gun.
No.
And he was always sort of somehow able to whip guns out of people's hands all the time. I thought that was fantastic. So
I
would get
a
branch of
a
tree and go around being Lash LaRue, you know, how you do when you're a kid. So, yeah. But, I think he was my favorite. But then I used to watch the usual ones. You got Roy Rogers over here.
Yeah, and The Lone Ranger.
And The Lone Ranger, yeah. Oh, I like The Lone Ranger.
And lots of the series like Wagon Train and...
Oh, yeah, okay. Bonanza, would you
Bonanza,
Bonanza
yeah,
and all
yeah.
that, yeah. Would
so
you call that a
them.
Cowboy... I guess it is a cowboy
yeah.
Bonanza and all of that. Yeah, yeah, and that Clint Eastwood one. You remember Clint Eastwood? Who cannot remember Clint Eastwood? Rawhide.
Me, I can't remember Clint Eastwood. yeah, Rawhide. I used to watch Rawhide as well, yeah.
And what was it? Oh, the High Chaparral was
yeah,
another one.
Yeah,
before,
that was another one.
It?
There were so many of them.
There were
I can't remember
them
all.
There were
a lot at that
there was
time.
Good guys and bad guys. It was in the days of the good guys and the bad guys.
The black hats and the white hats,
yeah. Yeah, and all of that sort of thing. So you liked doing that. And that, so that's influenced your writing. You would say that has influenced how you write and what you write in the story.
Recently, yeah. It's only since 2012 that I've been writing Western.
Oh,
stuff.
Really? Only since 2012 that you got into that.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit then. Oh, we might as well touch on that. Tell us a little bit about how you did get into writing cowboy stories. And
well, I've been writing obviously for a long, long time, including various novels which got sent off and sent back again. And then sometime early in 2012, I woke up one morning and I'd had a very vivid dream, and the dream was still with me, and it was a cowboy story, and it was still in my head as clear as day. It was like almost like a film running through my head. I had the title and the names of the heroes and everything, and it was just all there.
That's amazing.
And I just knew I had to write it,
yeah,
so
cool.
I sat down and wrote it, and a few months later I sent it off to Robert Hale, who were the only publishers I knew that did Westerns. And they accepted it pretty much straight away.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's great.
Just from a dream, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, so you believe in the muse then?
Oh, yes.
that sounds really good.
Because I'd had no success with anything, really, except a few articles and a few poems.
Except that, I don't know, Stephen King, for example, he wrote 5 novels when he was at university, none of which was ever published.
Mm.
And it's kind of a learning experience, isn't it? It's kind of practice. I mean, it's long-winded practice, because if you've written... Because I've written novels before. I got mine published. I've written them before. And it's all part of the learning curve. I think it's unusual. Well, it does happen that people get the first novel that they've ever written published.
Yeah.
I mean, that happened with, what's her name? Is it Harper Lee with To Kill a Mockingbird?
To Kill a Mockingbird, yeah.
I think that was one of her first ones that she wrote very, very early on and got published straight away. But that's sort of outside the norm. Most people have to write.
That's the dream, isn't it? That's the dream.
That's what people think they hope that they can accomplish. But I think that's fairly rare. I once described writing, novel writing as like running a marathon on your knees. It's that painful, and
it's very hard work.
That long, it takes that long to do.
I don't think people who are not writers realize what hard work it is actually writing a novel.
And it's a lonely job too, isn't it? Because you kind of, even if you're in an environment like a cafe, because some people do write in cafes or wherever they're writing, and there are people there, you're still sort of, you go into your own world as you're writing. So it really is kind of just you, the pen and the paper.
Oh, that's right.
Really?
Yeah,
so
you can blank everything else out and just get involved in it.
Concentrate on what
that's
you're,
right,
on what you're
yeah.
doing. I mean, that's the writing experience. But it's good. It's a good experience.
Oh,
tell
us
a little bit about the books that you have published then. It was the Robert Hale thing.
That's right, yeah. I figured that because it was a cowboy, a shoot-em-up tale, as I call it, I needed to have a shoot-em-up sort of name, really,
right,
because it would have looked silly having a cowboy story with my real name on the spine. Well, it wouldn't fit on the spine, would it, anyway, really? So I decided that it really needed to be something short and sharp that people could remember. So I took my great-grandfather's first name and my husband's great-grandfather's surname and put them both together. Right. Name Oscar was born.
Yeah, that's a great name. It's a good name.
I actually got an email last year from a gentleman in America whose name is Amos Carr.
Oh, really? Wow.
Which is very unusual.
What did he have to say for himself? Did he say, I enjoyed your books, or I'm Amos Carr, how dare you use my name?
No, he'd got the book from the library or from Amazon. I'm not sure where he got the book from, because he'd seen my name. He was intrigued to find out what it was all about. So he'd bought the book, but he hadn't read it at the time that he emailed
me. Right. Well, I'm sure he's read it since. Yeah. So that's great. So you published two books, is that right, over here?
Two with Hale at the moment.
With Hale, yeah.
Yeah.
What are they called?
The Ghosts of Pointer is the first one, and Crazy Man Cade is the second one.
Right, and were they written in fairly quick succession, would you say?
They were, yeah, they were both written in the same year.
Right,
They came out well, it was 2011, I think, when I wrote them, and they came out in 2012.
Right. And then what happened next in terms of the writing and publishing? And because I think you wrote another book.
Yes, I did, and sent that to Hale as well. But there was something in there that they didn't like, and so they sent it back to me. And at about the same time, I saw an article about this new publishers that had started in America that were looking for writers. And I thought, well, I'll take a chance and see whether they're interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I sent it off to them, and they were interested.
Yeah.
So with a few changes, obviously changing a lot of the language, the American language, because a lot of the words are slightly different, aren't they? So they had to make some changes there. But then they brought that out in 2014 for me.
Right, okay, great. Well, that shows something interesting, though. So I think a lot of people, well, I used to think that once you got published, then it was kind of automatic that you'd get published again. But it doesn't work that way,
does
it?
Oh, it doesn't,
Each book is sort of judged and assessed, and a publisher can easily turn around and say, no, I'm not interested in that, even though they've already published you a couple of times.
That's right. They have certain standards that they stick to for their particular line. And because I put some violence in that one, marital abuse, actually, in that particular one.
Like domestic violence.
And they didn't like that.
Oh, okay.
So that's why they sent it back.
Was their argument, do you think, because it might be read by children and they didn't want children to be frightened, or because it was too controversial a subject, or?
Perhaps it was a bit too controversial for that audience.
Okay, Okay, well, I think it's time for another tune.
This is
Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin.
A little song I wrote, you might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry, be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry, be happy. I give you my phone number. When you worry, call me. I make you happy.
Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no style, ain't got no gal to make you smile. But don't worry, be happy. Cause when you worry, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now.
don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Now there is this song I wrote. I hope you learned it note for note like good little children. Don't worry. Be happy. Listen to what I say. In your life, expect some trouble. But when you worry, you make it double. Don't worry. Be happy. Be happy now. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Don't worry. Don't do it. Be happy. Put a smile on your face. Don't bring everybody down like this. Don't worry. It will soon pass, whatever it is. Don't worry, be happy. I'm not worried.
Okay, that was Don't Worry by Be Happy. Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin. Would you like to tell us why you chose that?
That's my mantra.
Oh, okay.
I like to try and listen to that at least once a week.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, there's too much worry and misery in the world. And
yeah.
People should try and be happy if they can. And I try to live by it. Yeah. Not always, but yeah. I try to live by it.
I was sent an interesting article by somebody from a writer's group about writing, and whatever level your writing is, it said that writing is very therapeutic, and it's kind of helps you be happy.
That's right.
So, do you think that's true?
I think so. Because you can get into your own little world. And
So you forget about your own troubles when you're dealing with somebody else's troubles. You're creating problems for them. How much of your writing, because you're writing about Americans and cowboys, there can't be much room for anything autobiographical, obviously your knowledge of horses makes a difference. Does any kind of autobiographical aspects sneak in there when you're writing, or
no,
you don't think
all.
They do at all?
No, not at all. Well, as you say, except for the horses, which has always been a big interest of mine.
But there is a kind of an American Indian connection. Do you want to tell us about that? Because that fascinates me, that connection. Tell us about that.
That doesn't actually come into the writing very much.
No, but that got you started with writing, didn't it? Your interest in American Indians and your husband's connection.
It all happened at around about a similar sort of time, I think, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
My husband had never known who his real father was. And, his mother wouldn't tell him. And she passed away without ever having told anybody who his real father was. And he'd always said he wanted to know. He was always concerned and he wanted to know. So for his 60th birthday, I bought him a DNA test. And we put it onto the Ancestry website. And within a few weeks, we got a reply from a gentleman in America saying that he thought that they might be related in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some to and fro-ing, you know, with emails. And my sister-in-law had actually found some photographs when their mother had died. For some strange reason, she'd kept them, photographs of men in uniform. So I then spoke to Stuart in America and said, look, we've got these photographs. Could we send you them in case you recognize anybody in them as being a relative or a friend of the family? So we sent the photographs. And the very next day, I got an email back saying, we have a match. And it turned out that it was actually Stuart's uncle. So that Stuart and my late husband, Chris, are actually cousins.
Right, wow.
So it was quite a close connection.
Yeah. And he's American Indian, is he, or the uncle is, or?
they are related to, or they are, hang on, how many G's? Four times great grandsons of the Chippewa chief.
Wow.
A Chippewa chief.
Yeah.
Who comes from.
Yeah, so there's that connection there.
Yeah, so they've got the Indian blood. And I'd always said I wanted to be an Indian. And I'd always been really, really keen on Native Americans.
So you were attracted to a man who is in some ways part Indian,
yes,
part American Indian.
Yeah, you know, watch out what you wish for.
From
wanting to be an American Indian and being so keen on them all my life, I suddenly found out that I was married.
So do you think that helped get you sort of interested in writing cowboy stories in particular, or did that work on you subconsciously to think?
It may have done, because it was after that this dream came to.
Do Indians figure prominently in your work? Do you put American Indians in? I mean, you're writing a cowboy story. You have the American Indian sort of appearing.
No, there's only one of them that's got an Indian in at the moment.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I'm working on that.
Yeah. Do you feel that you have to be politically correct about all that, or do you write? Because we were talking about watching television in the 50s, and obviously back in the 50s, so the television programs that we watched, 50s and 60s, they weren't as politically correct as they are now. Do you feel under some pressure about that? And when you're writing these cowboy stories, especially with the violence and things like that, do you have to do you curb it down a bit? Do you dampen it a bit because of any kind?
No, you don't. Not really, not at all. No, especially not for America, believe it or not, because they like it raw.
Right, okay.
They're like the wounded heroes.
So you have to spruce it up a bit more. You have
add a bit more to it for America.
Right. Yeah. How graphic do you get? Is there lots of blood and gore, would you say, or do you?
I haven't gone that far, really, really graphic, but some of the other ladies who write for the same publisher get very graphic.
Oh, right.
Very graphic indeed. Like bones sticking out of bodies and all sorts of horrible stuff. I haven't got that far just yet. I might. It depends.
So this particular publisher doesn't have a problem with that kind of a violence?
No.
But what about the romance side? Because that's maybe the other side of the coin, if you will. This is all this lovey-dovey and kissing and cuddling. But do you have limits there with your new publisher? You can go as explicit as you want.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And I haven't gone that far yet either.
So, right. No, I was saying that you had. But again, I don't... Do you have your own... But you do have your own sort of... Do you draw a line in the sand yourself for any particular reason?
That I wouldn't...
That you wouldn't write. Mm. Yeah. That's just personal
language.
Preference,
that's
though.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Certain sorts of language that I wouldn't use and certain scenes that I wouldn't want to write.
Do you draw a line in terms of language, like the F word and certain, are there certain words that you wouldn't use or?
I wouldn't use that one.
No, you don't. You wouldn't.
No.
Okay.
But it's strange in that the American books, the language is very different. I use one particular word. Can I use that word?
Sure. Yeah.
I use the word goddamn.
Oh, right, okay.
And I was saying, can you help me? This is goddamn heavy.
Yeah.
Well, when I sent it to the editor in America, she sent back and said, we can't use that word because if people read the word goddamn, they'll shut the book and they won't read any further.
Oh,
you can use the F word as much as you like.
Oh, really?
In America.
But not that.
And they'll read it, but they won't read it if you use the word goddamn.
So they don't like bringing the word God
That seems right, I don't understand why, because the English words don't mind.
Well, that's political correctness, I suppose, the religious implications about it. So
it could be, couldn't it?
I guess, yeah. Well, that's interesting to know. Should we have another tune? You're Beautiful, James Blunt?
Lovely.
She smiled at me on the subway. She was with another man. But I won't lose no sleep on that, 'cause I've got a plan. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful, it's true. I saw your face in a crowded place, and I don't know what to do, 'cause I'll never be with you. Yes, she caught my eye as we walked on. From my face that I was fucking high, and I don't think that I'll see her again, but we shared a moment that will last till the end. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful, it's true. I saw in a crowded place, and I don't know what to do, 'cause I'll never be with you. You're beautiful. You're beautiful, it's true. There must be an angel with a smile on her face when she thought up that I should be with you. But it's time to face the truth. I will never with you.
Okay, that was You're Beautiful by James Blunt. Do you want to tell us why you chose that? Why in particular?
Well, like I said earlier, I like something a bit different, and I think he's got a very different sort of voice.
Yeah.
I just like the way he sings it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a good song. I like it. I like it too. We were talking earlier about your teaching career. You got into teaching.
Mm.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because you obviously, because your husband couldn't work, became a full-time teacher.
No, I wasn't full-time. I only went part-time because he needed a fair bit of care as well. So
oh, right. Okay.
Part-time. But it was further education.
Oh, right, okay.
Rather than in schools. Yeah. I didn't think I could cope with schools. So
but you got a teaching certificate, you did?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't finish your...
No, I didn't finish that, but because I was teaching creative writing.
Oh, right, okay.
They sort of, I think they knew that I knew what I was talking about to an extent.
Yeah.
So they let me do the...
Because you'd done some postgraduate, you'd done a degree by then, and some postgraduate study in creative writing.
There was some creative writing within the degree.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I went on later to do my master's in writing studies, which is part creative writing,
right,
part
okay.
English literature.
And that was before you did any teaching?
No,
or
that was after.
That was after you'd done some teaching. Yeah. So the teaching that you did in further education, where was that? Was that in Lancashire?
Yes, Accrington and Rosendale College.
Oh, Accrington and Rosendale College, okay.
And at various venues around the area for evening classes as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay, good. So was that... Were you teaching students there for a particular exam that they had to take, or?
Yeah, a lot of them were doing what they called O units, Open College O units and A units, which
okay,
I think are equivalent to a GCSE.
Right.
So not at the highest level, but
yeah,
sort of starter level, if you will. Yeah.
Are you still doing that now, or you,
no?
How many years did you do that for? Quite a while.
Oh, about 10 on and off.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
I was teaching a group of people with special needs as well, arts and crafts and various other things besides the writing.
And as well as all that, you had some kids as well, didn't you?
Just one.
Just one. You had one child, okay.
My daughter, Sarah.
A girl. And what's she doing now?
She's working as, I don't know what the politically correct term is, but she's working as a dinner lady
at one
of the local schools.
At one of the schools.
Yeah, because she's got two youngsters of her
own. So you got grandkids as well. So.
I have, yeah, James and Melanie.
So you've got two dogs and two grandkids and a daughter. So you've got your hands full. You've got plenty of people.
Do they come rushing around?
Okay.
No, they don't
interrupt your writing sort of on a daily basis?
No.
When you're writing, do you close yourself off and take the phone off the hook and all of that sort of stuff?
No, I don't mind being interrupted.
Because James Joyce, apparently, when he wrote, he liked to write in the kitchen, and the kids running around and all the noise and everything didn't bother him at all. I couldn't do that, but I mean, you obviously don't mind sort of...
I don't mind
any
at all.
Kind of noise
no,
or any that sort of thing when you're writing.
Yeah, I can put up with any sort of noise going on. Sometimes I like to be very quiet. If I'm editing, then I need to have a bit more quiet. But on the whole, it doesn't matter to me really whether anybody rings or whatever. I can just go back to whatever I was doing after I've spoken to them.
How do you go through that process, the editing process? Do you write the whole book in a fairly short period of time, I would say, because my understanding is you can write a book and you've written a book in like 3 or 4 months.
Mm, about 4 months, yeah.
Yeah. And then do you put it aside before you edit it to let yourself not think about it for a while? Or do you begin the editing process straight away? Or
I tend to edit to an extent as I'm going along. When I get to it one day, I will look at what I wrote the day before.
Oh, right, okay.
And edit that bit and then start again. And then when I get to the end, and finally written those famous words, the end, I do put it to one side for a little while and then go back and start.
What's a little while? A week, 2 weeks, a month?
Just a couple of weeks, that's all.
A couple of weeks.
Just to get it out of my system and think about something else for a little while and then go back to it again and go right through it from the beginning then a couple of times before I send it off to the publisher.
Yeah. I think I read in Peter's interview that you like to work on more than one book at the same time as well.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I've never tried doing that, but I mean, I have written bits and pieces between, but I don't tend to work on more than one book at once. Do you not get confused between one book and the next, or do you not sort of write one bit that should have been in the other book, or?
No. It's strange. I'm usually working on about three.
Three?
At a time.
Same time. Wow.
Mm. And two of them are usually the Westerns, which I'm working on at the moment. I'm working on two more, one for each of the publishers.
Yeah. Would that be in the same day that you would work on different books? Or would you sort of say, today I'm going to work on book A, and then tomorrow you might say, today I'm going to work on book B only. No. You wouldn't work on A and B at the same time?
No, on the same day. I think that might be confusing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No, it's just how I feel when I get up. It's just what happens when I open the computer.
How you feel. You don't even think about it. You don't even sort of say the day before, tomorrow I'm going to work on such and such. It's just how you feel when you get up in the morning.
Just wait till I open the computer up and then you say, see what pops into my brain.
Yeah.
Whichever book that particular thought fits into, then I'll work on that one.
All right. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm a great, as I've said, I think in another podcast, I'm a great believer in the subconscious. So, and Dorothea Brand says that when you get up in the morning, you should write first thing because whatever's been going on while you've been asleep, it affects,
You've got
a reasonable idea. Yeah. Do you write, would you say when you're writing a book, do you write straight from beginning to end? Or might you write chapter 10 because, I don't think 10 in particular, but a scene might come in your head, like the scene where he gets shot or whatever. Yeah. You might write that first and then go back and write the beginning. Leapfrog around. Do you plan your books? Do you have a meticulous outline saying in this, but I'm going to do this and this, the other thing?
No, not at all.
You just let it happen. Just let the characters decide for themselves.
They decide. They tell me what they're going to do and where they're going to be, and I just follow them along.
Do you have an idea in your head of like who are the good guys? Do you do good guys and bad guys? Are there?
Oh, yes. You have to have black hats and white hats, don't
you? Yeah. Well, I guess so. I don't know. I've never written a cowboy story, so I mean, but I did see plenty of them, and they did seem to. I didn't know whether we did that anymore. Because if I watch a Clint Eastwood film nowadays, when they do cowboy films, they're much more realistic. You know, you've got the mud and the dirt and all that. And they make them kind of like, I don't know, more intense.
And gritty,
yeah. And do you try hard to be realistic, to bring in a kind of a realism, do you think, to
I
your...
I do try.
Yeah.
I try, yeah, but of course, we can't really know the reality of the Wild West.
No, what it was really like.
We can never really know what it was like. So I as we were saying before about research, I rely on what I've seen.
Yeah.
There was a thing
called Tombstone on recently. Is that still watching? Do you watch Tombstone and things like that? The modern day cowboy stories are much different from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. I'm not so keen on the modern ones because I don't like the language that they use.
Oh, right. Okay.
I think they go too far.
Too realistic in that sense, yeah.
The language
is
the thing that puts me off.
Yeah, I must admit, I was watching Wolf Hall last night, and they were using the F word a lot, and I went and looked it up, and it really, at that period of time, that word was not used that much. It was only, I think it was 1457 that it began, you know, and it really kind of struck me as kind of more of a modern word, and they kept throwing that in, and it kind of spoiled it a bit for me. Not that I object personally to that word, but it was just, I just didn't perceive of it being used in the Middle Ages. Mm. So, yeah, the cowboy thing, I'm not sure.
Do we know very much
about how people talked? I mean, it was Victorian times, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, but of course, way out in the backwoods there, anything could have happened, couldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they did use that word, they did use that language, but I think you can have too much of it.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
it's too much it becomes, realism in that respect.
Yeah. And it gets a bit boring after a while, I suppose. Mm. You don't need to hear that. Yeah, I can understand.
I prefer
understand
the action. You know, I like to watch the action going on rather than listen to the language. Yeah.
Do you have a personal preference for dialogue or for descriptions or?
Descriptions, I think, are my.
You like doing the descriptions?
Yeah, especially of the horses.
Yeah. But you have to limit. Nowadays, readers don't have the patience to read long descriptions, so I suppose you have to sort of cut
That's
it down.
Why these books are not that long. They're more long novellas. They're more about sort of between 40,000 and 60,000 words.
Okay, yeah, that's quite true.
Instead of the 100,000 word that are
Mine's 150,000 words, to my regret. I need to sort of, well, you can tell, I talk a lot, I write a lot. I have to cut down a bit. Are we ready for another tune? Do you think we can have another tune? The Road of Tears, Battlefield Band, is it?
Yes. They're an Irish and Scottish folk group. And if you get the chance, try listening to The Road of Tears, because it ties in with what we were saying about the Native Americans, and about how they were hounded out of their land and forced to conform to the white man's ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know about, in Scotland, there was a thing called the Highland Clearances.
No, I don't know about that.
In sort of the 17th and 18th century.
Okay.
Where rich people cleared all the peasants off the land to make space for what they thought was a more profitable sheep. So people were cleared from the land and the houses were burnt and they were forcibly removed to America and Australia. And this song talks about the Highland Clearances. It's one verse is about the Highland Clearances and the next verse is about the American
Indians,
atrocities.
The same thing. Yeah.
And they alternate the verses, and
that sounds
an
interesting
very good
song.
Story. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear The Road of Tears then. Battlefield Band.
They came at dawn from out the darkness, swords and torches in their hands. They said it was the chieftain's orders. Clear the hillsides and the glens. No more we'd smell the broom and the heather, share the bannock with our kin, be laid to rest beside our fathers. It almost broke our hearts and minds to board the ship of tears. Board the ship of tears. We crossed the sea to flee the hunger, wasted rags of skin and bone. The fields we left were black and barren, a ravaged land no longer home. coffin ships were filled with mourning, we'd one last look back to the land. The quiet men, the women keening, it almost broke our hearts and minds to leave the fields of tears, to leave the fields, the fields of tears. They came in floods, in covered wagons, drove across our ancient lands. They set to scorn our elders' wisdom, take the path their Lord commands. They stole our hills, they stole our rivers, the Mother Earth with whom we're joined. They led us from our spirit fathers. It almost broke our hearts and minds to walk the trail of tears, to walk the trail of tears. They came in hordes across the desert, storms of dust that sear the skin. They said they'd come for our oppressor, they would make a meal of him. They said that we would air our freedom and come to see their ways right. But still we weep and we are bleeding. They have not won our hearts and minds. We're on the road. We're on the road of tears. It never ends, the road of tears, the road of
Okay, that was The Road of Tears by Battlefield Band. A good song. And again, why you chose that, because you feel empathy for that,
because
whole situation.
I have Scottish ancestry. I've always felt that Scotland was home. And, the clearance is something that really chimes with me. And it's so similar to what was happening with the American Indians as well. And it's just a song that puts them both together and makes you realize how similar the two.
What do you think would happen if you wrote a book where the American Indians were the good guys and the cowboys were the bad guys, and you sent that off to your publishers? Would they sort of say, no, we can't take that. This is
the English publishers might say that, but the American publishers wouldn't.
They would say okay.
Because I don't think I mentioned Prairie Rose Publications, who are the American publishers. They're a company that's run by women for women writers.
Oh, right, okay.
So they've only got women writers. And a lot of them actually do use the American Indians as the heroes in their books as well.
Yeah, so that's quite acceptable now.
That's right,
open to that. Right. Have you been to America? Have you ever been over there?
No, never.
You've never got a hankering to go over and sort of get yourself into a gunfight or...
Not really.
No. Right. You haven't got any guns at home then. You haven't got any sort of pistols.
I've got a holster, but I haven't got a gun for it yet.
You've got a holster, but you haven't got a gun for it yet. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, how about your reading experience then when you were younger? Were you, If you studied at university level, you did lots of reading and cultural studies and all of that sort of thing. But what about your fiction reading? Did you do quite a bit of fiction reading as you were growing up and as you were getting up to your writing stage?
I did. When I was young, I was a real tomboy, and I used to read all the cowboys and Tarzan. I used to read things
like that.
You know, Jungle Book and Tarzan and Treasure Island and all the things about pirates and Indians and adventures. I don't think I ever read a girl's book. I think it was always boys' books when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I don't think I read girls' books until I was into my 20s, really.
Yeah.
I would class as girls' books, you know, romances and things like that.
But they were all books connected with your own personal taste, really. They weren't books that were required reading for your studies or anything like that. But you must have done some English courses. Presumably when you were when you liked English in school, you were required to read.
I can't even remember what we read at school.
No,
I didn't do any qualifications or anything at school.
Yeah.
I left without any qualifications.
Yeah.
So I can't even remember what we wrote.
But even in your teaching, in terms of your teaching to teach creative writing, did you, in the coursework that you had to do, did you not have to read particular authors? Did they not say, read so-and-so to learn how to write such and such? Or did they not emphasize that so much in the creative writing courses?
Not really. They did give us pieces by various different writers to look at and study. But again, I can't really remember how many, you know, which ones there were now.
It's, so you read sort of essays on writing, essays about how to write, but not necessarily writers themselves.
We read a few different writers, but I can't really remember which ones there were now, to be honest.
Yeah. Are there any authors who really, that you feel that really influence you now, or?
Not that influence me as such, no. I like Mary Stuart's Merlin trilogy.
Right.
I thought that was really good. And there's a poet, I don't know if you know him, an Austrian poet called Rainer Maria Rilke, who is like a metaphysical poet.
Yeah, I do.
I really like reading his work.
Yeah.
But really, I can't say that I've had any real influences, no.
Right. Okay. So but speaking of poetry, so do you try to be poetic when you're writing? Does that come into the flow of your, because you said you like writing descriptions. Mm. Do you worry about style, or do you just let your own style, is it a straightforward sort of style that you attempt to achieve, or do you try to keep a rhythm and a poetic aspect to it?
I've never thought of it.
You don't think of that when you're writing.
Poetic or anything. No, I just
Whatever seems to sound right on the, on the page.
Yeah. Nobody's ever said it was poetic.
Well, just because nobody's ever said it doesn't mean it isn't true. Yeah, so it could be. So you're working on three books now.
Yeah.
At this current period of time, and you hope to get those finished relatively soon. Send those off.
Sometime this year is all I can say, really. I don't know. It just depends how well I do with them, really.
Do publishers ever say to you, we're looking for such and such and such and such, we're looking for a story about such and such, or we're looking for...
No, they haven't done yet. That's probably when you get a bit more famous, they'll start asking you.
Right, but when you were...
A long time.
When you were researching the publisher, when you were thinking about sending it off, you obviously looked at their website and read about... Because I've read and heard that it's important that you not send books off just to any publisher. You have to consider what the publisher is expecting.
That's right.
Before you send it off to them. So you were fairly careful about that.
Well, I knew that with the Robert Hale books, as far as I was aware at that time, Robert Hale was the only publisher in England that actually still published Westerns.
Right.
So I knew that I would...
So you immediately sent it off to them. You didn't think about any other publisher.
No, I just sent it straight to them. And I was extremely lucky in that they liked it and took it on straight away.
Yeah, that's good.
And with the American publisher, there was just a little piece that I read. I can't even remember where it was. I read it now. It must have been in one of the writing magazines that just said that they were looking for more female writers that could write Westerns.
What role do you think luck plays in all of this? In all of this sort of getting published and writing the right thing and having this subconscious kind of like dream that says, this is what you should write and all that sort of. Do you think there's luck involved in a lot of that, or is it just
a lot? I think.
Yeah.
If we know what luck is, I think it's a great deal of luck. I was just lucky that Black Horse, who is Robert Hale, that they did like Yeah, work at the time because they could have easily sent it back like they did with the third one.
Yeah, and said no, we don't like it.
And I've had plenty of rejections over the years, so that would have just been another one to add to the pile.
Yeah, I've had rejections too, but when you get those, they always sort of say, at least a lot of the agents have said to me, well, you know, it's a subjective process and you've just, effectively, you've just been unlucky this time. Mm. Maybe next time you'll be lucky. And I never know whether they're kind of like saying, well, they're keeping their door open so that in case you write this magnificent sort of fantastic book or become extremely popular, they've got room for you later. But,
it's a standard response.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So can we believe it then? Or is it just hype? Is it just blurb that they send back?
No, they are very specific needs, and if you don't fit what they're looking for, then they know what they want. They know what's selling. That's their job. They know what's selling.
Okay.
So if your outline doesn't actually fit with what's
selling, the important thing is believing what's going to sell.
Studying the market.
Yeah.
And finding out what's selling at the time and trying to write something that's like that.
Yeah.
Or even being ahead of the game. And
do you think that a writer should, if a writer wants to get published, a writer should then try to write what is wanted? Or should you just do your thing, and if it gets published, or is it up to you? It's kind of up to you, isn't it, really, I guess?
Everybody writes differently, though, don't they? I think you should believe in yourself and just write what you feel is right.
What you want
yourself
to write, yeah.
And if it fits the criteria, all well and good.
But okay.
If you can get ahead of the game by writing something that you believe in, and, you know, they might not know that they want it until they get it from you.
Right. Well, that sounds like a good note to finish on, a good upbeat note. Thank you, Jill, for coming for talking to us or me. And I thought that was great. I thought it was brilliant. I really enjoyed talking to you. And I think I've learned a lot. I hope the listeners have too. So we'll finish on one last song. I'd Do Anything for Love, Meatloaf.
Oh, yes, Meatloaf. My hero.
Oh, that's why you chose him.
My hero, yes, he's always been my hero. I've liked him for years and years and years. And he can't do anything wrong as far as I'm concerned.
Okay,
and
good.
And this particular song, the video that goes with it is based on Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
And Beauty and the Beast is my favorite story and always has been. So it all ties in well together.
Okay, we'll finish off then with Jill's favorite Meatloaf.
I would do anything for love. Some days I pray for soul. Some days I just pray to the god of sex and drums and rock and roll. And maybe I'm lonely, that's all I'm qualified to be. That's just one and only promise I can keep. As long as the wheels are turning, as long as the fires are burning, as long as your prayers are coming true, you better believe it, that I would do anything for love. And you know it's true, and that's a fact. And I would do anything for love, and there'll never be no turning back.
But I'll never do it better than I do it with you. So long, so long.
No, I won't do that.